Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Sigurd Neubauer about his just-published book, The Gulf Region and Israel, Old Struggles, New Alliances. Sigurd Neubauer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sigurd, it would probably be nice to start with a little bit of an intellectual history of yours and how you got to writing this book.
The book has been in the works for about a year and a half. And I would say that I have really written several books before the final version came to its fruition. Because initially when I set out to write the book, I thought the book was primarily going to be about the rift between Qatar and its immediate neighbors, and my focus would be on the diplomatic process, which was spearheaded by the United States with support of Kuwait, and also analyzing some of the propaganda warfare that took place in the United States. So that was the first draft of my manuscript. But then things started to change. And one of the remarkable changes that we saw, of course, was the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Oman. And it was an unannounced visit. And it was framed within the framework of the peace process. And that, to me, was the first sign that this was a much larger struggle that was playing out in the Middle East. So from that point on, I started rewriting the book. And then as more and more sources came, became available, I had to change a lot of the premises once again. So it is almost 2 years of work before this book came to its final fruition.
Tell us a little bit about what sparked your interest in this in the first place.
My interest in the Gulf region really began in late 2008, 2009. At that time, I had first gotten my start in Washington as a foreign policy analyst, and I moderated several events with various ambassadors posted to the United States. And through that, I was able to attend the Manama Dialogue in Bahrain and the Bahraini ambassador to the United States. She was so kind to invite me. And I traveled in late 2010 to Bahrain, where I had the opportunity and privilege to interview the foreign minister. And we discussed the Arab Peace Initiative. And from there, I traveled to Oman and UAE. And it just, at that time, it just became a fascinating world for me, because it was right before the Arab Spring. And then, of course, when the Arab Spring came to fruition in early 2011 in Bahrain, it really changed the dynamics quite significantly.
and almost related to your book, the ambassador of Bahrain who you were referring to was the first Arab ambassador who was Jewish.
Yes, that is correct. And in fact, I had lunch with her and her family in Bahrain, and it was just really, she was really a wonderful person, or she still is a wonderful person. And it was when I first met her, Bahrain was really doing quite well. It was confident, it was progressive, and it really had a positive message, I think, that resonated beyond the Gulf region, and she was kind of the symbol of that.
The book really is about two sides, and it's two sides of the same coin, granted. One is the what was your starting point, which is the rift in the Gulf between Qatar on the one hand, and on the other hand, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt. And then it's about relationships between the Gulf and Israel. And what I'd like to do is start off with the rift in the Gulf itself, which is also where you start, really, in your book. And one conclusion that I thought one can draw from the book is that the best one can hope for is a face-saving accommodation, that a real solution would have to involve a 180-degree turnaround on one of the two sides in terms of basic policy principles. With other words, Qatar adopts UAE-Saudi attitudes, or the Kingdom and the Emirates accept the principle of countries following policies of their own.
Yes. Yes, that is really where the de facto line is. And I think it's really important to understand that that was the U.S. position, because what we do know now from the benefit of hindsight was that Saudi Arabia had asked President Trump personally for his permission to invade Qatar. President Trump, with the support of Secretary Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson, obviously rejected that. And what they did was that they said, we are not going to accept that proposal. And instead, what we're going to do is that we're going to resolve this within the tent of the Gulf, which is to say that the United States called on Kuwait to mediate. And in the background, the Americans were supporting or pressuring the parties to light up on Qatar. That is the story. And if you look at the timeline as this feud escalated, you will see that the blockade was imposed on June 5th. On the 6th, the Saudis asked for permission to invade Qatar. President Trump told them no. And then it took about 3 weeks, almost 3 weeks after that. It was first on June 19th that Tillerson said, requested that the feuding parties should announce announce their grievances against Qatar. And that is when the 13 demands came out. And the 13 demands came at the point where basically the crisis was over as far as the United States was concerned. And the 13 demands were issued in a way so that the grievances could be articulated in a manner that the broader public and expert community could understand.
But they were also demands that essentially, if met, would have undermined almost totally Qatar's independence and sovereignty.
Yes, that is correct. But by the time these demands were issued, the United States already knew, and the parties already knew, that no military steps against Qatar would be supported by the United States. And because the Egyptians at that time also had a rotating seat on the UN Security Council, the Egyptians had opened up for a UN Security Council investigation of Qatar, and that was something that the Americans shut down immediately. President Trump, as a matter of fact, called Sisi when the four foreign ministers were from the blockading states were in Cairo you might recall that there was a very awkward press conference where all of them were together. And one of the expectations at that time was that Qatar would be expelled from the Arab League. And that was also an intervention that happened by the United States before the 13 demands came out. So I would say that, yes, it is true that the 13 demands would have crippled Qatar, but they came at the point where the U.S. position was pretty clear, where it stood vis-a-vis the need to patch up the rift within the Gulf while at the same time protecting Qatar's sovereignty.
Which basically leads me to another conclusion from your book, which is that the rift in the Gulf has simply hardened fault lines. And it strikes me that you see that in two ways. One is that while Saudi Arabia and the UAE appear to harden their insistence that others adopt their hardline opposition to dissent, political Islam, and you see countries like Turkey, Qatar, and particularly Qatar, anchoring in law exactly the opposite by, for example, recognizing the principle of political asylum. And the other thing that strikes me that you see is that basically every mediation attempt, whether by the big powers, whether by the United States, by the Europeans, by the Russians, or by the Chinese, has failed. That they're simply, at least on one side of the divide, there is no interest in resolving this in any form of negotiation.
Yes, that has been the consistent factor throughout this crisis. And now we are, of course, 3 years later, and the blockade is still in place. And Qatari citizens and businessmen cannot travel into the blockading countries, and it has become the status quo. And of course, over these past 3 years, we have seen that the Iranians have attacked Saudi Arabia's strategic oil facilities. And we have also seen the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. And neither of these two mega events in the cause of geopolitics has really moved the sides closer to any effort to engage in reconciliation.
I mean, the entrenching of the fault lines raises more fundamental questions of whether the differences are structural rather than political. And that's particularly given that Qatar sees itself as a country sandwiched between two of the region's behemoths, Iran and Saudi Arabia, and both are friends, partners, whatever you want to call them, and potential threats, prompting Qatar to ensure that it would be politically that it politically would not in it resemble either of the two behemoths.
Yes, I think that the way that the West is viewing the crisis is very different than the way the Gulf is viewing the crisis. Let me give you an example. In the West, I think that the Gulf region as a whole has suffered tremendous reputational damage. It is clear that this is a personality dispute between the rival monarchies of the Gulf, and that in the interest of strategic collaboration, resolving this crisis would be better off. That is how this is seen in the West. In Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, I think that there's a very different view. And the view in Abu Dhabi and Riyadh is that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have won this conflict. Qatar is boxed in. Qatar has very little room to maneuver in the region. And as President Trump and his policy towards Iran fluctuates, Abu Dhabi and Riyadh can deal directly with the Iranians on their own terms. They can deal with the Israelis on their own terms, and they deal with the Americans on their own terms. And Qatar is just not a factor to them. That's how they see it. In Qatar, of course, they are extremely frustrated because they still fear the worst could yet come, that their regional adversaries are just waiting for the right geopolitical opportunity to finish what they had started. So this is how I think the conflict is being seen in Doha, how it's being seen in Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, and of course in Washington, where the Americans are very frustrated by the lack of movement.
I mean, the other side of the coin is that you could also argue that the UAE and Saudi Arabia are in a cul-de-sac when it comes to Qatar. They've failed to get the support of any major power, the United States, Europe, Russia, China. And in fact, the desire to see the Gulf Rift go away may be the only thing big powers agree on these days.
Yeah, and I would take it a step further. I would say that the Israelis also opposed the rift between the Arab states and took concrete steps to prevent any encroachment made by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia against encroaching on the U.S.-Qatar strategic relationship. So if you look at all the actors internationally within the region and certainly the global powers, it was only the four blockading states and some of their surrogate partners that supported this rift. Internationally, there's a consensus that this was a crisis that was needless. And what is interesting, I think, personally, is that it was the three non-Arab powers of the Middle East, namely Iran, Israel, and Turkey, that each, for their own reasons, came to the defense of Qatar.
Right. I mean, another conclusion from your book, I think, is, and from your analysis, is the detailed portrayal of the failed mediation efforts, which means that the only likely way to end the rift is in a larger context, like a rejiggering of security arrangements in the Gulf, something that may be inevitable, but maybe still a ways off.
Maybe. I think one of the challenges that you're dealing with in the Gulf is that there's tremendous frustration with President Trump. They will not publicly admit it, but his zigzag policies and unreliability, as they see it, has brought serious question marks to the present U.S. role in the region. At the same time, the United States is an extraordinarily attractive partner for the Gulf states, for both sides of the dispute, because the United States respects sovereignty and respects the sovereign decisions of these monarchies to carry out their foreign policy and domestic affairs as they see fit. Whereas many other countries, including in the region, they have a client state approach towards the smaller Gulf states. So if you, for instance, look at the United Arab Emirates as a case in point, it is still a small country, and its outsized power is directly tied to its decision to link itself directly with Saudi Arabia. If it didn't have that partnership with Saudi Arabia, Oman would balance out UAE for two reasons. First, Oman is larger geographically, and it also has a larger population. And as we have seen, Oman has been successful in balancing between maintaining strategic partnerships with the West and at the same time have good relationships with Iran and Israel, which is not an easy thing to do. So in the case of the United Arab Emirates, because it is still a small country, it feels that it has a bigger role to play in the region for a variety of reasons, and it is able to do so because of its relationship with Saudi Arabia. If you cut that relationship, or if that relationship somehow changes, then the UAE goes back to just being one out of six member states. And if you look at the various party partners that the UAE has in the region, whether it's Egypt and Israel, it is limited where it can go. It has now, as we know, an adversarial relationship with Qatar, with Oman, and certainly with Turkey and with Iran. So there's not a lot of movement for the UAE should it seek alternative arrangements, because the terms with either Russia or with Iran or China are not going to be favorable to the status quo which it enjoys with the United States. And I would argue that that is true also for the smaller Gulf countries as well.
Which also explains the relationship with Israel. Perhaps we can start off on Israel by describing how difficult it was to report and write that part of the book.
That was really the hardest part, because there was just a lot of assumptions that was being made during the Gulf crisis. And one of those assumptions was that when you had neoconservative surrogates in the United States going out and explicitly criticizing the Qatar-Hamas relationship and suggesting, or not suggesting, but really implying that because there was a relationship between those two entities, Qatar was supporting terrorism, and because it was supporting terrorism, the United States needed to withdraw its base from Qatar, and that was a way to quote unquote punish Qatar for its behavior. And then, of course, Al Jazeera became a factor as well because of many of the unsavory guests that the network has hosted over the years. And it just became this almost perfect storm, if you will. And for non-experts, it was tempting to believe that Israel was, in effect, supporting the blockade. That was a reasonable conclusion for non-experts to make. But if you look deeper, and I had read extensive literature about the Qatar-Israel relationship, which for the most part had been a very positive relationship over the 13 years that had taken place. And if you look at Israel as a regional actor, has always sought to make inroads in the Gulf, and both in terms of confronting Iran and having a base in the region, but also as a way to reach out the hand in peace, if you will, to its Arab neighbors. So it just, if you had that basic understanding of the Israel-Gulf relationship, coupled with the fact that Qatar had always honored its pledges to bring money for Gaza reconstruction, then the premises that Qatar supported terrorism and that the Qatar-Hamas relationship, which had always been complex, but that all of a sudden that equation had changed, that was a red flag to the seasoned observer. And of course, with the benefit of the hindsight, we saw that legislation to designate Qatar as a state sponsor of terrorism was introduced in the Congress, and the fact that AIPAC and pro-Israel groups never picked up that legislation, that was a clear sign that the Israelis did not support it, because the issue of Hamas and terrorism in Gaza is clearly within the domain of AIPAC and pro-Israel groups.
Yeah, although a lot of those relationships, of course, went much further back. Qatar is the only Arab state that
officially and above the table has invested in Israel. Look at the stadium in the football stadium in Sakhnin. The Israelis have been selling non-lethal equipment to the Saudi military for decades. While the relationships with through people like Adnan Khashoggi and others who even visited Israel. So in effect, those inroads were long there. I mean, you had Israelis, foreign ministry officials with dual passports going back and forth every month.
Yes.
So those relations were longstanding. And what seems to have happened more is that both sides felt more comfortable, particularly the Gulf, about being more overt about the existence of the relationships, and then closer cooperation on intelligence, security, and things like that.
Yes, but I also think what is interesting, again, with the benefit of the hindsight here, is that it has also been clear to me the miscalculation from the United Arab Emirates in particular, believing that its relationship with Israel and believing that there is enough uncertainty about how the official Qatar-Israel relationship came to an end, that was an opportunity to take some to play on that uncertainty and bring it in front of an untested American administration, and so to speak, relegate an old the feud between the Al Nahyans of Abu Dhabi and the Al Thanis of Qatar. And that is also why I call my book Old Struggles, New Alliances, because the struggle between the Al Nahyans and the
rulers of Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, and the Al Thanis go back a very, very long time. And to kind of use or believe that neither the Israelis, the Americans, and the Brits would be unaware of these bad tribal relationships and kind of look at the relationship between the Gulf states and Israel as they started from scratch with the ascent of President Trump, that to me is perhaps the most disappointing aspect of it all, because it fundamentally underscores a complete miscalculation of what the United States is, how the United States sees the region, and how the Israelis, quite frankly, see the region, and how they have been engaging with these parties for a very long time.
That was sort of evident in what you, maybe not in those words, but essentially describe as the watershed in certainly for the UAE in developing relations or deepening relations with Israel, namely the complicated and controversial acquisition in 2005 of Britain's P&O steam navigation company.
Yes.
By Dubai's state-owned DP World. The acquisition sparked congressional opposition to the inclusion of six U.S. ports in the deal.
Yes.
Why was this a watershed in significantly tightening already existing unofficial relations with Israel?
Because the United Arab Emirates saw that it was vulnerable in the post 9/11 environment in the United States. And during that time, there were a lot of question marks in terms of U.S. policy towards the region. The United States had, of course, suffered the biggest terrorist attack in its history, at least since Pearl Harbor. And at that time, the United States had decided to use all the resources at its disposal to fight what at that time was called the War on Terror. And the United Arab Emirates was a small country. And because two of the 9/11 terrorists had come from the United Arab Emirates, the United Arab Emirates was afraid that it would get caught up in that massive massive anti-extremism narrative that existed in the United States at that time. And when congressional Democrats decided to play politics with the United Arab Emirates, it was a strategic threat that needed to be mitigated. And they saw an opening. They turned the crisis into an opportunity, and they saw an opening in terms of partnering with the Israelis in framing a message in Washington, which focused namely on the following: our interests are aligned with the Israeli interests. And so the United Arab Emirates took concrete steps to broadcast that message both to the Americans and to the Israelis. I discuss in my book the back channel that was instituted between the United Arab Emirates and the Israeli Ministry of Defense, and how that back channel led to greater coordination on Iran policy, because that was ultimately what the Israelis were concerned about. This is, of course, pre-Arab Spring. And so that is really how the United Arab Emirates relationship with Israel became a strategic partnership, because as we know, the two countries do not enjoy formal diplomatic relations, but the coordination within the security field warrants to describe the relationship as a de facto strategic partnership.
You describe indeed that evolution in great detail. Maybe you can talk a bit about the role of the UAE ambassador in Washington, Yusuf Al-Otaiba, Israeli Major General Amos Gilead, Defense Ministry, and also the role of the primarily Geneva-based companies often operated by Israelis that were really doing a lot of the business.
Yes, and what is interesting is that if you look at the timeline of 2006 and 2009, during this timeline, Israel UAE was really playing up with catch up with Qatar, because at that time, the Qatar-Israel relationship was flourishing. We have seen that during that time, the Americans, with the support of Israel, specifically asked Qatar to host the Hamas Bureau. We saw that Qatar had secured a seat on the UN Security Council through the support of the Israelis, and used its seat to sponsor a UN Security Council resolution that brought an end to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. So this was in 2006. And as the United Arab Emirates, we know, of course, that they are fiercely competitive with Qatar. And I would suspect that one factor to strengthen its relationship with Israel was not just about the Washington influencing game and shielding its reputation from the turbulent partisan politics and during the 9/11 era, but it was also as a way to balance a little bit with Qatar and at the time the strong Qatari-Israeli relationship.
Both countries have benefited from the relationship in more ways than meet the eye. Perhaps you can describe how.
I would say that if you look at all the Gulf countries, they are by definition really small countries. Qatar has, as we know, 230,000 citizens. The UAE has a couple of million. And Oman has about 6 or 7 million, if I remember correctly. And these countries have all sought to play a larger role within the Gulf region, but also internationally. And Israel is really the only country in the Middle East that has strategic depth, that is able to have a sustained impact on U.S. policy. And there are no constituencies in the United States that automatically support the Gulf states, other than the expert community, of course.
Well, Israel's the only Middle Eastern state that has a grassroots.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, we have really seen since President Nasser of Egypt that the security of the Gulf region has been tied to the security of the Levant and to the Israeli-Palestinian theater in particular. And if you look at when some of the relationships between the Gulf states, with the exception of Oman, of course, and Israel really came to fruition was during the right after the Madrid talks of 1990, early 1990s, and then, of course, the Oslo process. And at that time, the United States wanted to anchor Israel-Gulf relations as part of a broader Arab-Israeli peace. And so the Gulf states found that they could benefit quite significantly from cooperating with the Israelis, and they could help transform the relationships with the United States in the process.
And then you had the botched killing of Hamas operative Mahmoud al-Mahmoud, in Dubai, which in which it was clear that the Israelis were responsible for the killing, and yet it didn't really have an impact on the relationship. Tell us a little bit about the incident and why it did not have that kind of an impact.
These kind of incidents are directly attributed to the vision of the leader. And for Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, from his perspective, he had put significant prestige in his relationship with Israel. He had allowed the Israelis to open up a trade office in Dubai. He had allowed the Israelis to have a presence through the UN organization dedicated to renewable energy in Abu Dhabi. And all of a sudden, you had the Israeli prime minister, approving an operation to kill a Hamas operative in Dubai. And that was extraordinarily damaging, I think, both for the Israelis. They got caught. Of course, they never admitted or denied the operation, which is standard with their practices. But from the UAE, they had to condemn it, and they had to save face. And there was a little bit of a downgrade in relationships at that time. But again, the broader strategic benefits that the UAE benefited from Israel, especially if it was going to play a larger role in Washington, would not allow for the UAE to fully break from the Israelis. And I think it's also important to understand that the relationship between the UAE and Israel is not a relationship among two equals. Meaning, Israel is much stronger in that relationship because of its capability, its influence, and the United Arab Emirates is, after all, a small country in the Gulf that seeks to play a larger role than its natural size, and it can only do so by having a web of alliances and partnerships. And one of those partnerships is through Israel.
I mean, you've sort of hinted and talked about this, but let's like to flesh it out a little bit in the sense that the UAE's clout in Washington has been enhanced as a result of its ties to Israel. But certainly when it comes to Qatar, that really hasn't been a success story, neither in terms of influencing U.S. policy or in terms of getting legislation passed in Congress.
Yes, and I would say that is both it has been a failure for the United Arab Emirates because it has fundamentally not understood Washington and the Israelis. From a Washington perspective, yes, in Washington, there is plenty of room for lobbying and influencing campaigns and so forth. But at the end, in the United States, there are huge bureaucratic interests that favors the status quo, whether it's the Pentagon, the military, the State Department, the intelligence organizations. And ultimately, policy is set by government and not by outside influence groups. And to believe that you could cook up a influencing campaign, take it to the president, and the president would tweet, and then Qatar would fall like a domino. That is a fundamental misreading of how the U.S. government works. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect is that the Israelis made a strategic decision to counter Iran. That is the number one threat to its security. And from that perspective, inter-Arab fighting only potentially strengthens Iran's hand and creates more turmoil. And remember, the Israelis have seen the dynamic against Qatar before. I mean, it was in 1996 that the same four states that went after Qatar in 2017, when they tried to unseat the emir of Qatar at the time, Sheikh Hamad, and it was that event that led Israel to establish relationship with Qatar to begin with. So in other words, the Israelis had seen this before, the Americans had seen this before, and they were just not going to let that happen. And I think also, I'm speculating, but from an Israeli perspective, you can both have a good relationship with the UAE and Qatar at the same time. You don't have to get into these sort of regional struggles. And I think that that is the perspective that they had when the crisis broke out.
Which takes us to the Israel-Qatar relationship, which is a very different relationship from that with the UAE. And in some ways, you could argue that Israel has become part of Qatar's defense strategy. And I wonder whether that explains some of the UAE hostility towards Qatar.
I think that the UAE was surprised that Israel would play such a decisive role. I think that they were surprised that the Trump administration would not support these kind of policies. And I think that they were surprised that countries such as Iran and Turkey would also put the brakes on preventing inter-Arab squabbles from becoming hot conflicts. And Israel, from that point of view, really is in line with the rest of the international community. It's in line with France, with Britain, with Germany, who all supported the Gulf reconciliation while at the same time working practically with both sides. So I think that if anything, we have seen that Israel is, the way that it operates is very much within the Western orbit and within the Western consensus.
Do you see changes domestically in the Gulf that explain the difference in attitudes towards Israel at times of heightened tension with the Palestinians? Look at, for example, the closure of the Israeli office in Oman and the downgrading later closure of the office in Doha during the Intifada, as opposed to the responses now as Israel moves towards annexation.
Well, let me just put it in a different term. I think that if you look at the United Arab Emirates, they have engaged Israel openly. They have engaged in soft power issues such as opening up a Jewish community and the United Arab Emirates. And these are important messages to Israel and to Jews in general that the United Arab Emirates views Israel as a positive role in the Middle East. And I don't think that will change with the annexation debate per se. In case of Qatar, I think it's very important to emphasize that in Qatar, there is an understanding that Israel and American Jews are not an adversary. In other words, in Qatar, there's an understanding that the campaign against them was something that was organized by their own neighbors, and that American Jewish groups and Israel actively refuted to get dragged into that war or into that conflict. So in other words, that has strengthened, in my observation, the view of Qatar, the view of Jews, and the view of Israel among Qataris in general, because Qataris in general remain unbelievably angry at their neighbors for having been cut off from their cousins in neighboring countries and from even visiting family and conducting business. And they have a great understanding of what the Gulf crisis was really about. And the fact that in the Middle East, that they don't believe that there's a Jewish conspiracy in this game, that's actually a net positive out of a bad situation, I think.
Which leads us to Gaddafi's relationships with Hamas, with Hezbollah, which have been helpful to Israel, but contributed to the souring of its relations with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and also in some ways complicated Palestinian politics.
Yes, and if you look at reconstruction of Lebanon in 2006 after the Israel-Lebanon war, that at that time the Qataris presented themselves as an Arab power working on reconstructing Lebanon and helping the Lebanese people avoid another costly civil war. Of course, that is one aspect of the story. The other aspect of the story that has not come out until now in my book, of course, is that all of that coordination took directly place with the Israelis. It was the Israelis that provided Qatar with the space to operate in Lebanon, and it was the Israelis that provided the space for Qatar to operate in Gaza. And in that aspect, the Israelis elevated Qatar's standing as a Arab power, so to speak, even though it's a very small country.
You describe Al Jazeera as the real thorn in the side of the Israeli-Qatari relations. Describe what you mean by that.
Well, if you look at the positive tenets of the Qatar-Israel relationship and how they were cooperating really well in Gaza and in southern Lebanon, and they were actually trying to build peace after devastating conflicts, and you had the Al Jazeera network savaging Israel, that made the Israelis unbelievably angry because they felt they had such a good relationship and warm relationship with Qatar, and Al Jazeera was savaging them. Now, having seen it from another aspect, it just seems to me that the explanation for that is very simple, and that is that the Qataris never shared with Al Jazeera what they were doing with the Israelis. So the Al Jazeera was so to speak in the dark about the broader strategic issues that were taking place, and activist journalists who had their own bias and often in case an anti-Israel bias just ran with their own ideological agenda, if you will.
I mean, in all of this, Oman is the odd man out, which meant that its relationship to both Israel and the United States was very different. But also, it was as much, in many ways, a target of the Emiratis as was Qatar.
Yes. I think what is important to understand, again, looking at how the Israel-Oman relationship began, and it began really with Qaboos. Sultan Qaboos, as we know, defied the Arab consensus when he did not boycott Israel's peace treaty with Egypt in 1979. And Sultan Qaboos actively supported his friend and mentor, King Hussein of Jordan, and his quest to make peace with the Israelis. And Qaboos did so because that was, of course, in 1979 and in the mid-1990s, respectively. But Oman's relationship with Israel really began in the 1970s, right after Qaboos came to power. The Israelis helped him fight the Dofa rebellion in Oman, which was, of course, the civil war led by a communist invasion from southern Yemen into Oman. And the Israelis played a key role along with the Iranians by providing military planners and help Qaboos win that war. So from that point of view, Qaboos really enjoyed a very favorable view of Israel, and during time of crisis really has seen Israel as a reliable strategic partner Of course, Oman is an Arab country, and it frames its relationship with Israel through cooperating for advancing a lasting peace between Arabs and Israelis through the Palestinians. That is how the relationship is framed publicly. But in private, it was very much tied to Qaboos's vision for the country and to his positive relationship with Israel as such.
Can you talk a little bit about the Omani-Emirati relationship attempts of, not dissimilar to with Qatar, but Emirati efforts to change the regime in Muscat?
Yes, yes. In 2011, right as the secret back channel between the United States and Iran took place in Muscat, the Emiratis tried to topple Sultan Qaboos for the first, tried to topple him right at that time. Of course, what we saw the U.S. position at that time was to, again, keep these kind of feuds within the Gulf. So officially, it was Kuwait that brokered the détente, if you will, and Mohammed bin Zayed, along with the Mohammed bin Rashid of Dubai, they came on an apology tour to Oman. They were picked up by the Emir of Kuwait personally, and they flew together, and they came and apologized to Qaboos. So that was in 2011. Then, of course, what we did not know was that after the first rift between the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, in 2014, the United Arab Emirates had made a decision that its diplomats in the United States and elsewhere were not to fraternalize under any circumstances with their Omani colleagues. And when President Trump came into office, the Emiratis tried to exclude Oman from participating in Jared Kushner's peace talks or peace talk group meetings with the GCC members.
Which was the Israeli, yes. The Israeli Palestinian peace talks.
Yes, exactly. And then, of course, there were a couple. There were other things that they did that really angered the Omanis, and that is that they deployed troops right on Oman's border in southern Yemen in Mahra province. And they used it under the pretext of clamping down on smuggling weapons into the Houthis. But of course, as we know, there are no Houthis in Mahar province. And then after Trump became president in January 2017, we saw that they moved troops from Mahra to Socotra, which is another Yemeni island, and they started systematically to attempt to isolate Oman from the Trump administration by arguing that, quote, Oman was too close to Iran and that it was too close to the Obama administration, and the non-experts and political outsiders in the Trump administration felt susceptible to that kind of rhetoric, because on one hand, the Emiratis were talking up their own relationship with Israelis and framing it in a way that they were confronting Iran. And at the same time, they were talking down Oman's relationship with Israel. And then, of course, as we know, Oman was isolated during the Riyadh summit in 2017. And it was seen as a continuation of efforts to isolate Oman from the Trump administration. And then finally, there was another spy ring that was discovered in Oman in 2018. And after that spy ring was discovered, that is when Netanyahu's visit to Oman became a rushed event. It was something that was only, from what I understand, planned for several weeks, for about 3 weeks or so, to get him to visit Oman and to demonstrate Israeli support for Oman's sovereignty and independence.
Which leads us to another conclusion that you draw in your book, which is, and I'm paraphrasing it, which is that at least from the UAE perspective, the war in Yemen is not just about the Houthis, or maybe not even primarily about the Houthis, but much more about the encirclement of Oman.
Yes, because the UAE seeks to establish itself as an Arab power, and the UAE, by supporting the Southern Transitional Council, which is a movement that, at least on paper, seeks to revive the Southern Transitional, the Southern Independence Movement that we know from the 1960s and 70s, that it fits a larger vision of the UAE as a mercantile power with economic interests in East Africa, around the Horn of Africa, and trying to push out Omani competition from Omani ports so that the Dubai ports and other Emirati economic interests, including by trying to scoop up some of the ports in southern Yemen, would make the United Arab Emirates a regional power that can compete potentially regionally with Iran and perhaps even with Saudi Arabia at the future stage. That seems to be the Emirati vision, and taking on Oman or challenging on Oman fits that objective.
Sigurd, there's so much in your book that we could probably talk for another hour. And unfortunately, we don't have another hour. But what I would like to do before I let you go is tell us a little bit about what you're working on now and what you're looking at in the future in terms of what you want to do.
Well, right now, obviously, I'm working diligently about promoting the book. And one of the things that I want to promote with the book is the role of Israel as a strategic partner that is acceptable to all the Arab, to all the Gulf states, whether it is to the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Israel. And understanding that Israel is a stabilizing power in the Gulf is an important realization that I think many in the experts community don't quite understand. And that is to say that Israel is actually putting a lid on many of the inter-Arab fights that have devastating strategic consequences for the broader region and even for the world. And shifting the conversation, focusing on Israel playing a positive role within the Arab arena, as opposed to collaborating with the Gulf states to confront Iran, is an important change in how we understand the region and how more and better realistic policies hopefully can be crafted in which collective security again is restored as a norm to U.S. Arab relations.
Problem with that, of course, is that the Palestinian issue is the black swan.
Yes, and the Palestinian issue is an issue that there's no way around it, of course. But I also think what has become clear is that Israel is not going away, obviously, anytime soon in the Middle East, and that it has been a stabilizing force which leaves the Gulf states with little room to continue to work with Israel despite their rhetoric on annexation. So in my humble opinion, I think that the Gulf states do obviously not want to see annexation, but they're already drawn too far into their own diplomatic games with the Israelis that they can give that up easily, even if Israel moves forward with annexation.
So how does that translate into what your next project is?
That is a question that I'm still trying to figure out myself. But for now, the foreseeable future will be dedicated to promoting my book and hopefully make a positive contribution to the broader understanding of the Gulf region.
Sigurd, thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. All the best and take care.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.